From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. There's a new tension between U.S. business owners and workers, and it's not just in baseball. Across the country, some of America's biggest unions are threatening to go on strike. A beleaguered Boeing has offered machinists a last-ditch contract to stave off a work stoppage. The White House says it will step in if longshoremen on the West Coast vote to shut down the nation's Pacific trade. The economy is already reeling. American workers are feeling the pinch, and every day frustration grows. This hour, organized labor fights in a flailing economy. First, we begin with the awkward rift between the United States and Saudi Arabia. The Saudi leadership insists it will not support U.S. military action in Iraq. Yesterday, Saudi Prince Bandar met with President Bush at the president's Texas ranch to seek at least the appearance of common ground between the two old allies. But disagreement overshadowed the meeting. Earlier, I spoke with Gregory Gause, director of the Middle East Studies Program at the University of Vermont. I asked him where Saudi-U.S. relations stand.
Well, the relationship has had a number of blows since 9/11, that's for sure. And I think that this is part of an effort by the administration to, on one level, repair it at the public relations level. You know, a very high-profile visit to the ranch by the Saudi ambassador is a signal from the president, both to American public opinion and to Saudi Arabia, that the administration still values the relationship, despite the rather heated criticism that the Saudis have been under in the United States.
But Gregory Gause, can public relations deal with this rift? The policy statements coming from each side could hardly be more opposite. Vice President Cheney saying, we've got to do this, we've got to go into Iraq, and practically every Saudi on the record saying this is a bad idea.
And I think that it is more than public relations that is driving the change in U.S.-Saudi relations. The Saudis don't see the same kind of threat from Iraq that they did in 1990-91, and they're very reluctant to, as it were, move outside of an Arab consensus on this, largely, I think, because they're worried about what the public opinion reaction in their own country would be. So I think that the conversations down in Crawford have a lot to do with not just the public relations, but probably trying both sides to feel out if there's some level of cooperation that they can achieve that won't entail the Saudis publicly being involved in, say, opening up their bases to the United States forces.
Crown Prince Abdullah, Saudi Arabia's de facto leader, was represented by his foreign policy advisor publicly yesterday, saying that Saudi Arabia's opposition to war against Iraq was firm. He said there's no country in the world that supports it. There's no international sanction for it. There's no coalition for it. This doesn't sound like a country in a deal-making mode.
I think it sounds like a country that's basically echoing the views of other Arab states and also European states, probably trying to signal the administration, as some people here in the states are, that, look, if you want to do this, you better get some backing, you better consider UN moves, you better think about how getting the weapons inspectors back in might make things easier for you, not harder. I think that there's a lot of that kind of signal sending going on. If the Saudis were looking for a complete break with the U.S. over this and other issues, I don't think Bandar would have gone down to the ranch.
This is Prince Bandar, who's, of course, been Sultan, who's been in the United States for many years.
Right.
At the same time, however, we have Donald Rumsfeld saying we don't need unanimity. We can go ahead without anyone who's not in agreement. If the United States goes to war with Iraq without Saudi Arabia on board, what does that mean for the future of this relationship?
I think it depends completely on how the war goes. If it's fast, it's quick, it gets rid of Saddam, and there's a stable aftermath, I think probably the relationship can be repaired. But if the war drags on, if it takes a long time, if it stirs up a lot of public opinion discontent in the Arab world, then I think that that's just yet another element in what is the changing U.S.-Saudi relationship after 9/11.
What do you think are the deepest Saudi fears about this war threat to Iraq?
I think that the biggest fear is that if it happens that Saddam resists, that the Americans take casualties, that it's a long, drawn-out thing, and that leads to public eruptions around the Arab world, perhaps even in Saudi Arabia itself. I think that's their worst-case scenario.
Can this ruling family, House of Saud, walk the tightrope between Arab opinion, Saudi Arabian opinion, and United States expectations?
It's a tightrope walk that they've been doing for decades, and so far they've done it pretty well. And this is a tough patch, there's no question about it. But right now, I don't see any organized force in Saudi Arabia that can change the regime in the short term. The question is, what will the Saudis do to try to maintain that balance? How far will they move away from the United States? They want to distance themselves as far as possible publicly without breaking from the United States in the long term, because they have a security interest in maintaining that relationship with the United States.
Beyond regime change in Baghdad, we hear senior U.S. officials talking about redrawing the political map of the Middle East. Mm-hmm. Do Saudi Arabia's leaders hear that as a threat to them?
I think that they hear it not as a direct threat, more in the sense of disquieting them, in that a major American push for democracy, the way we understand it, with full elections and that kind of thing, would obviously lead to a split with us in Saudi Arabia. Right? So far, the administration has made it clear that its notions of democracy here are much more gradual than what they're talking about in a post-Saddam Iraq. And so it's not a direct threat to the Saudis, but it's obviously something that they factor in as they look at the new relationship, the new changes in the United States post 9/11.
To maintain support at home in Saudi Arabia, how far do you think Saudi Arabia's leaders will have to go in resisting U.S. war plans in Iraq? Might they pull out the oil weapon?
I don't think they're going to pull out the oil weapon. They've been very clear in the lead up to this that oil isn't a political weapon and it's counterproductive for Saudis to use it that way. They've got their own revenue problems, very different than it was in 1973. But I do think that there'll be no use of Saudi bases, just as there were no use of Saudi bases for the Afghanistan campaign. The questions to me are more indirect. Will the Saudis allow their airspace, not their bases, but their airspace to be used by American Air Force planes? Will the Saudis encourage the smaller Gulf states like Kuwait and Bahrain and Qatar to allow the U.S. to use their facilities, or will they push them to close off those facilities to the U.S.? Because the Saudis have quite a bit of influence in those smaller states. If Iraq was on the agenda of the president's discussions with the Saudi ambassador today, it seems to me that it's those kinds of questions that are probably the ones under discussion.
And we have to presume it was on that agenda, don't we?
I don't know, because it seems to me that one thing that this administration is trying to do is to avoid the notion that it has made decisions about how it is going to deal with Iraq. That it is set on a particular course, yes, but that it has decided the technical details of this, no. They've said all along there is no plan, no plan has been decided. And to some extent, you can avoid problems with countries like the Saudis or Egypt by not asking them questions that you're afraid they might say no to until further down the road.
On the other side of a war with Iraq, do you see a U.S.-Saudi relationship standing in a form that we have known it?
I don't think it's going to be in the form that it's been since the Gulf War, where there's been, you know, a very strong military component to it, where there have been American troops stationed in Saudi Arabia. I don't think we're headed for divorce, but I think we're headed for a more distant relationship, cooperative on things like oil and economic issues, but with a less military element to it.
Gregory Gause, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Gregory Gause is Director of Middle East Studies at the University of Vermont. He spoke with me earlier today from Burlington. We're talking tonight about organized labor and the teetering economy. With the economic slowdown threatening millions of American jobs, important unions are gearing up to strike. But is this the time to strike? Could picket lines undermine a shaky recovery? And after a decade of boom and bust, how are working people doing in America today? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me tonight from Berkeley, California, is Professor Harley Shaken, Professor of Education and Geography at the University of California at Berkeley. He's also Director of Berkeley's Center for Latin American Studies and an expert on labor, trade, and global economic integration. Good evening and welcome, Harley Shaken.
I'm delighted to be here.
It's great to have you. Harley Shaken, we look out across the labor news today, and we see a lot of potential strikes in the wings. It looks like a new season of labor management conflict. Why is this coming now when the economy is in such bad shape? I guess, do labor unions somehow see opportunity in spite of the fact that numbers are down on all sides?
Well, if we look at the specific strikes that are threatened, for most of these workers and unions, they feel they have little alternative but to act now, whether it's the longshoremen on the West Coast, Boeing, United Airlines, or any of the other potential strikes. They're all very important. They're all highly visible, but they yet don't make up a trend. So I think what we're seeing now is a lot of uncertainty in the economy and several high-profile situations where we could see major strikes.
And what is it about this moment that makes these high-profile unions say we must act now?
In part, it's simply when the contract expired. But it isn't just the contract expiration date. It's several issues that the unions feel they must act on now, or the future will really leave them behind. For example, the strike at Boeing with the machinists union.
Mm-hmm.
One of the key issues of that strike is globalization, whether a more competitive Boeing will do more manufacturing offshore in places like China, whether it will do it in Seattle or Long Beach.
Boeing is already doing that. I think they've laid off 30,000 workers in the last year. They've moved a lot of work to non-union shops in the U.S. and abroad. Can a union standing up and saying enough have an impact when you've got global competition going on?
It's very tough, but the union retains significant leverage. Their feeling is if they don't exercise that leverage now, however inopportune it may be in terms of the overall economy, it will be far less 3 or 4 years from now.
The globalization word comes up early and often in this conversation, and I guess it leads anyone who's looking at American unions to say, do American unions have a chance to stand up and build a wall around wages and pensions and health benefits in an economy where people are competing with workers in China?
Well, I think what American unions are seeking to do isn't to build a wall, but to develop a new internationalism. And it's not easy. It's going to be very tough, but it's essentially reaching out to a global economy, but asking that that global economy play by certain rules where they will not be the victims of globalization. In some industries, unions retain considerable leverage, and I think what we're seeing is these unions seeking to use that leverage to establish these rules of the game.
What do you mean by a new international relationship? One can only imagine what machinists in China make compared to what they make in Seattle or Kansas, where big Boeing plants are. What relationship can be established that protects the wage rates and aspirations of American workers?
Okay, I think that one would have to look at this at two levels. On one level, trade policy, and this is where unions have played a real leadership role and a very different role in recent years, essentially saying, look, we want to see a global economy, but we need labor standards that all countries who trade abide by. So the World Trade Organization, for example, or a regional trade agreement like the North American Free Trade Agreement, ought to have, according to unions, labor standards that seek to harmonize upwards. Not the same rules, but the same rights for workers in these countries.
Is that protectionism dressed up in other language?
No. I think it's very different than protectionism. We have protectionists. Pat Buchanan's a protectionist.
Mm-hmm.
He makes no bones about the fact that higher walls make better neighbors. The AFL-CIO is going in a different direction. It is essentially saying we realize the reality of a global economy, but if we need strong protection for intellectual property rights, for corporations, for profit repatriation, why don't we have comparable rights for workers? And the key here isn't simply the benefits for union members, but rather for the entire economy. Lower wages, the flip side of lower wages is lower demand.
Only 1 in 10 private sector Americans now even belong to a union. How much leverage does the American labor movement have in that situation?
Those are pretty grim numbers, and we're approaching historical lows. We'd have to go back to the 30s to find something comparable. So one shouldn't make light of those numbers, but the numbers don't tell the whole story, because in certain key industries, such as auto or aerospace, unions still retain quite a wallop. It isn't, for example, Boeing. The numbers have been decimated in recent years, as you mentioned, you know, from 40,000, 45,000 a few years ago to around 20,000 right now. But it isn't just 20,000 workers. They remain central to the core part of a global production process. It isn't just their skills, it's their imagination and their participation in that process that makes Boeing the successful competitor it is.
Lucky them, an awful lot of other American workers have seen their jobs go overseas, and a lot of unions have seen their memberships fall. We're talking tonight about America's unions maybe striking back. If the 90s were the hot corporate decade, the CEO decade, could this be the workers' decade? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Harley Shaken, please stand by. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about America's unions striking back or maybe striking out. A lot of high-profile labor negotiations are underway right now, and maybe some high-profile strikes coming down the path. Could it be that the pendulum is swinging back to American labor, or is this labor's last stand? Is it right, is it patriotic to strike in an economic slump? And does the union message speak to you today in 2002? Did it ever? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Coming up on Labor Day, what do you make of the state of American labor? We've been talking with Harley Shaken at University of California, Berkeley, an expert in global labor issues, author of Workplace Industrial Relations and the Global Challenge. I want to welcome to our conversation right now Richard Trumka. He's National Secretary Treasurer for the AFL-CIO. Good evening and welcome, Richard Trumka.
Tom, thanks for having me on. It's good to be with you.
It's great to have you. Richard Trumka, look out at the very big picture with us here.
Sure.
We're coming up on Labor Day 2002. We've come out of a boom decade that was not equally shared, but it did raise a lot of boats. How, before we even get to the union level of this, just look at America's working men and women. What's your assessment of how they're doing coming out of the boom economy into this bust?
Well, I think it's good that we take a look at that. And if you look, workers are facing some pretty tough times. Unemployment's risen steadily throughout the Bush administration. It now stands at 5.9%. African Americans and minorities are even worse. African Americans are right now at 10.7%. People are out of work for longer periods of time. Altogether, there's 9.8 million people that want to work but can't find jobs, and 1.5 million of those people have been unemployed for at least 6 months. Massive layoffs continue in corporate America as accounting fraud and the corporate abuse leave thousands of our workers without jobs and security for their families. Wages aren't growing as fast as productivity. Over the past year, for instance, Tom, average hourly earnings rose by 2.7% in real dollars, but labor productivity was up 8.3%. Working people are watching their retirement savings dry up in this severe downturn in the stock market with the low interest rates. And the president's threat to privatize Social Security will only add to their growing sense of insecurity. Perhaps one of the most outrageous things is you got 40 million Americans right now that don't have health insurance. And that's not because they're not working, because the vast majority of those uninsured right now, at least 80% of them, live in a family with at least one worker. And then I guess I come to my favorite subject, which is manufacturing. That's a sector of the economy on which working people really depend and have depended for good-paying jobs and steady jobs, and that sector has been decimated. Manufacturing employment's down 2 million jobs since April of 1998, a million in the last 12 months alone.
Mm. So do you see, Richard Trumka, a comeback in the works here for America's labor unions, or do you see a last stand in the making?
Well, if you reach out there, the good news for America's unions right now is that over the last several years, each and every year, every age group and every sector of people have said that they now look to unions as a solution not only to other people's problems but their own problems. In fact, the recent surveys that we've done show that truly about 30 million workers, if given the opportunity, would join unions.
Then why the low membership?
Well, it's tough. The laws are skewed against us. Frankly, let me point the finger at us first of all. Mm-hmm. Some of it's our own fault. We haven't done a good enough job of organizing in the past, and we're working very hard to change that so that more and more unions are devoting more resources to organizing. We're focusing on low-income jobs, minority people, as well as high-paying jobs, skilled jobs, professional jobs. So we're doing a better job. In the last 2 years, we actually have grown in membership. But you also have laws that are stacked against us. You have an economy right now where there's massive layoffs, and employers, when you try an organizing drive, threaten to shut down a plant, and there's enough plants that have shut down around them, not because of unionization, but because of other jobs, that threat becomes real. Every year, Tom, 10,000 workers are fired for simply trying to join a union, illegally fired, I might add, and it takes them on average a couple of years to get back to work. So it's difficult at best with the laws stacked against us. It's not to say it's impossible, and we are doing a better job.
We're talking tonight about working men and women in America. Does the union message speak to you? Did it ever? Does it today? Are labor unions history in your life? Can you imagine them returning as a key national force? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. We're talking with Richard Trumka. He's National Secretary Treasurer for the AFL-CIO. And with Harley Shaken at the University of California, Berkeley. Harley Shaken, when you look at the 90s and how American workers did, what's your assessment? We know that a lot of CEOs made out like bandits, in some case were bandits, but was this shared bounty for working people?
Well, I think in retrospect, the 90s were a fabulous decade, but for many workers, they had to read about it versus experience it.
What do you mean by that?
I mean by that the CEOs, the people at the top of the economic ladder, experienced direct and measurable benefits throughout the 90s. For most hourly workers, it was a far more insecure and harder way to go, even during the boom. So real wages slowly increased at the latter part of the decade, but that was after decades of decline, and the insecurity that pervades the workforce, even when unemployment was low, mm-hmm. was a very real factor. So those at the bottom end really didn't experience the 90s as it's been portrayed as a boom decade, mm-hmm. and even workers right in the middle had a lot of insecurity and slow growth.
Richard Trumka, what about that? In 1982, we read the average American CEO made 42 times more than the average production worker. Today, that's supposed to be about more than 400 times more.
411, to be exact.
411. Do you see, and of course, we've all seen and read the stories of executive misbehavior and in some cases criminal behavior. Is that changing the American mood, the American cultural perspective on labor and management in a way that's advantageous for unions?
Well, you know, you hate to say that the bad fortune of people and the improper and sometimes illegal action of other people is good for working people. Most people want to join unions because they know that they're going to get better wages and better benefits. They're more likely to have a good pension plan, a good health care plan, and better job security. They'll get better treatment on the job. That's why they join unions. Now, this what we see right now with this period of what's happened in the market, actually, I believe, started in 1995, whenever the Gingrich Congress actually deregulated the capital markets and made it more difficult for shareholders to rein in directors, rein in accountants, rein in analysts and things of that sort. And so the horse was then out of the barn. And the other thing that I think where it hurt workers, Tom, is we were told back then, you remember all the dot-com companies, those were the corporations of the future, mm-hmm. those were the cutting-edge corporations. Well, we find out now that the cutting-edge corporations were a fiction, and real corporations, corporations that had been around for a long time, a corporation like AT&T, for instance, had to compete against this fiction. So it began coring itself out, just like the dot-coms, the WorldComs, the Enrons were doing, and laying people off and weakening itself. And now all the workers that were laid off are having to pay the price for that fiction. They really weren't state-of-the-art. They really weren't making money. They were staying in business and creating the illusion of profit by funny accounting. Now, that's hurt all of us.
We're trying
that's
to get
hurt, that's hurt the economy. Mm-hmm. That's hurt business. That's hurt the country. And collectively, we have to change that.
We're trying to get a grip on what the labor reality looks like on the other side of the 90s bust in the midst of globalization. Tonight, we're joined by Richard Trumka, National Secretary Treasurer for the AFL-CIO, and Harley Shaken at University of California, Berkeley. Rick is calling right now from Spokane, Washington. Welcome, Rick. You're on the air.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
I own a manufacturing company in Spokane, Washington.
Okay.
And I actually have a mentor who ran their own. It was two men who ran their own manufacturing company for 50 years. And I've talked to them about using union labor. And
do you use it, Rick?
I don't, actually.
Okay. Why not?
Well, pretty much I have found that anything that has anything to do with production has been moved overseas. And as an American manufacturer, it's hard to compete with the prices that they're getting for labor overseas. I would love to be able to have employees and be able to take care of them, but the price point for what I sell, it doesn't make it work. The only way that I'm able to survive is just by doing custom work or specialty work.
So you're saying as a manufacturing plant owner that you can't support the benefits that you feel union labor would deserve?
No, I don't feel that I can. And the people that actually mentor me feel the same way, because we're competing against manufacturers overseas. They have lower labor prices and other things that make it less expensive for them to produce the products that we actually consume in America.
Harley Shaken, this gets right back to the nub of it. I think it's hard for people to figure out how you maintain a standard of living in America that depends on successful business when you're competing with wages overseas that are so much lower.
We really need rules of the game that level this out, because what we're looking at now is exactly what Rick's talking about, a hard downward slide. What we're seeing in countries like China or Mexico is what one might call high productivity poverty, very advanced productions at wage levels that are 60, 80 cents an hour sometimes, and are artificially depressed by a lack of labor rights.
But when you talk about new rules, are you imagining a global minimum wage? Can we even conceive of such a thing?
No, I don't think we have to go there. I think we could look at something like basic labor rights as part of trade agreements.
And you think that would push up the price of production overseas so that Rick in Spokane, Washington could employ American workers and still be profitable?
It would push in the right direction. It would change the direction. And it isn't simply American workers right now. We're looking at the decline in Mexico of 300,000 jobs in the border export plants in the last year alone, because those jobs are moving in to China. So if $1.50 an hour in Mexico is an unreasonably high wage in the global economy, how can a plant like Rick's compete? Changing the direction of this becomes a vital part of trade policy, but it's something that doesn't simply affect union workers. It affects everyone who lives and works in this economy.
Richard Trumka at the AFL-CIO, what about Rick's problem? He'd like to be able to pay what American union workers want and need, but he says he just can't do it. Harley Shaken says we need new rules to make that possible. Do you see, can you imagine, rules imposed by the WTO or even unilaterally by the U.S. government somehow changing the scenario to make union labor more competitive in the United States?
Well, first of all, I have a tremendous amount of empathy for Rick, and I'm glad to know that he's still here and he's still making things in America. And several outside factors or factors of the economy affect him. The strong dollar affects his ability to export products. The tax code that rewards companies that go overseas and punishes him for staying here ought to be changed. We need to look at all of those. But when you look at it, Harley's right. Take China, for instance. We've now granted them permanent normal trade relations, or permanent most favored nations. The workers there have no right to organize. They have no right to bargain collectively. So they have no way of moving their wages up and getting a fairer share. Their wages are controlled by the government. Second of all, their employers there have no environmental standards. So Rick, I'm sure, is trying to manufacture products properly in accordance with all the regulations in this country designed to keep a clean environment. He has to compete against companies that do none of that. In addition to that, you know, you have human rights standards. All of these can be negotiated into trade agreements. Take a look at the Jordanian agreement. Some of these safeguards are put into those trade agreements, and they can have a beneficial effect. They're not going to stop things overnight, but they will in the long run help workers in other countries increase their wages. When they do that, they become a bigger market for our product. Now, here's the other thing that hurts Rick. You have a $450 billion trade deficit, the largest in our history.
This is the U.S. trade deficit right now.
That's right. And it takes $1.3 billion every day to service the debt on that. That's $1.3 billion in capital.
Coming in from overseas.
Well, it used to be. It's not coming in from overseas. Now they're starting to pull out because of their skittishness. That's taking money, a capital away from Rick, him being able to expand his products. It's taking capital away from the country. All of this means that guys like Rick, small manufacturers, are our natural allies.
Rick,
people that
Rick,
want to produce stuff here, we want to work with them and help them produce things here in the United States.
Richard Trumka, let me put it back to Rick. Rick, you sound like a young man. Do you imagine, can you foresee in your lifetime being able to hire up a bunch of American union labor and march out into a changed global scene where that would be competitive?
Well, first I'd like to make another comment about the exchange rates on the dollar. Somebody else had mentioned the strong dollar, but I have lost a lot of bids to Mexico and Canada inside of the states because those countries can, first of all, produce it more cheaply, but also with the exchange rate, they can undercut my prices for, like in Canada, up to 30%.
So do you see it changing, Rick, or are you looking offshore?
I don't know. It's hard for me to tell. I'm going to stick with it and keep trying, but like the others have said, in America, it's pretty tough.
Rick,
hey, Tom, can I add one other thing to while Rick's still on the line?
Sure, Richard Trumka.
What he said is a very, very interesting point. You know, whenever we negotiated NAFTA, we were told that there were tariffs on Mexican products, and I think they averaged 17% to 22% at that time. And we were told, gee, we're 17% to 22% more competitive.
Mm-hmm.
But then immediately afterwards, they devalued the peso, and we were about 150% in the whole. So in these trade agreements, we also have to put some kind of monetary policy that pegs currency. Now, what China does to keep that advantage over people like Rick, they peg their currency 20% below the dollar. And when the dollar goes up, they go up. When
it just floats
down,
right there, 20% below.
It floats right with them, so they always have a 20% advantage. Now, we can change that. And I truly believe that with the skilled workers and the great management that we have in the United States, that we can do two things. We can compete in a global economy, and we can pay people decent wages and benefits while we do it.
Rick, thanks so much for your call. Harley Shaken, you've heard this conversation. You talk about new rules that would make a manufacturer like Rick more able to compete. Do you see those on the horizon? Is it realistic to hope for them?
I think it's very realistic to hope for them. And we can look at the recent battle over fast-track legislation, which gives the president the right to negotiate trade agreements without congressional amendment. The key issue in the congressional debate over fast-track was whether or not it would have labor and environmental protections built into the legislation. It passed by one vote the first time, and in the final bill, it passed by a 3-vote margin in the House. That shows a very, very closely divided Congress over this pivotal issue, which directly addresses what Rick was talking about earlier and what Rich Trumka is talking about, how we level the playing field and, in fact, and in some ways ironically, expand the potential for trade. Because the flip side of very low wages that are depressed by a lack of labor rights
is no market.
Mm-hmm. So what you wind up with is export platforms and very few markets. That's not sustainable long term.
What a picture. We're talking tonight with Harley Shaken at the University of California, Berkeley, and with Richard Trumka, National Secretary Treasurer for the AFL-CIO, about America's unions striking back or striking out. What do you think? What's the state of the American worker today? Better or worse or just different than our parents' generation? After the high-rolling 90s, is it labor's turn? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about America's unions striking back or striking out after a big boom decade in the 1990s. If the 90s were the hot corporate decade, the CEO decade, could this be the workers' decade? And is it right, is it patriotic, as some unions are, to threaten a strike in the midst of an economic slump? And maybe we have to ask, is there a post-union model for working America, given low union membership in this country? Or are unions still the way? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined by Harley Shaken. He's a professor of education and geography at the University of California at Berkeley and a labor expert. And by Richard Trumka, National Secretary Treasurer for the AFL-CIO. We're also joined right now on the line by John. Welcome, John. You're on the air.
Good evening, gentlemen. How are you?
Well, thanks.
This fits in kind of with Rick's question, and it also goes with a question that Tom just posed to us.
Mm-hmm.
Is it patriotic to strike during an economic downturn? And my question is a counter to that,
okay,
which is it patriotic for American-based companies to be moving these jobs overseas during economic downturns?
Mm-hmm. It's another question that goes right to this globalization issue. And, John, thanks very much for bringing it in. Richard Trumka, what about the whole patriotism issue here? Does it have a place in the economy in an era of globalization? Is there room? Can we afford to think in patriotic terms about American workers and their interests?
Well, I think, you know, these are the same workers that following 9/11, the attacks of 9/11, were hailed as heroes. And while they were hailed as heroes and given lip service, now whenever they're fighting for their health care, somehow somebody would try mm-hmm. to make that unpatriotic. It isn't. I think John asked the appropriate question. Is it appropriate, is it patriotic for corporations to move all of their productive facilities offshore? Is it appropriate and patriotic for them to reincorporate in another country so that they don't pay taxes here and further destroy the tax base when you have budget shortfalls in 43 states right now, and 22 of them have cut health care services further, 7 have cut social services, and in this time of mm-hmm. of terrorism and this war, 25 have cut public services. Now, so the question becomes, is it patriotic? Now, the system of collective bargaining mm-hmm. is a system that has served this country well. It has allowed management and workers to air out their differences, and most of the time, 90-some percent of the time, 99% probably, it ends up without any kind of economic action, either a lockout by management or a strike. It works well. We need to be looking at that institution, the institution of collective bargaining, and strengthening it, particularly in times of downturn, because that's when workers are most vulnerable. That's when they need the strength of a union and the power of collective bargaining the most to protect health care, to protect their pensions so they don't get wiped out like they did at Enron and like they did at WorldCom.
We can all see that and support that, but it gets so confusing in a globalized period, Richard Trumka. It leaves one asking or wondering, is it possible that somehow the interests of the U.S. economy are now at odds with the interests of the American worker? Sometimes it's almost presented that way.
No, I think they're very, very, very consistent. And if you look at what the American workers done, the increases in productivity of the American workers, particularly American manufacturing workers and industrial workers, have given to the country, that's been very, very good. What's been bad for the country is deindustrializing it, taking all of our manufacturing facilities, sending them to China. So that China can become the platform for the same corporations to supply all of Southeast Asia. I mean, the question becomes, what obligations does a corporation have to the community within which it does business? Mm-hmm. That's the debate that we should be having right now.
Richard Trumka, it's been great having you tonight. I know we have to let you go, but thanks so much for being with us.
Tom, I hope you have me back again. And just let me say to Harley one thing. Harley, happy Labor Day. And I want to thank you for all that you've done for America's workers. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Richard Trumka is National Secretary Treasurer for the AFL-CIO. He was president of the United Mine Workers Association. We're talking tonight about America's unions striking back or striking out after the dot bust. What do you think? Is there a post-union model, or is it still all about, at some level, unions? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Mikhail is calling from Nashua, New Hampshire. Hi, Mikhail. You're on the line.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Good to have you.
I actually wanted to make a few points. Well, first of all, I absolutely agree with the previous caller, Ricky, I believe, who said, well, it's important that countries like China have labor laws similar to the United States so that workers can protect mm-hmm. Their interests. It's also important that in other countries follow the same ecological standards.
But do you imagine that actually happened, Mikhail?
Well, let's presume that we live in an ideal world for a second.
That's a big presumption, but we'll go with it.
Right, because I actually want to make another point.
Okay.
The problem with all this moral mumbo-jumbo about patriotic or not being patriotic while moving jobs overseas, I don't think it actually is very moral to think in these terms, because people in the Philippines, people in China, people mm-hmm. in Russia mm-hmm. need jobs as well, actually much more than American workers.
So what should the United States be doing in the interest of its workers and global morality?
And I tell you what. Actually, you wouldn't see Intel moving their jobs overseas. You don't see Microsoft moving their jobs overseas, because high-tech industries need specific type of workers. qualified workers, which are hard to come by, especially in countries that are less developed.
Mikhail, we've got it, and I think I'm glad you've raised this argument, and thank you for your call. I want to put it to Harley Shaikin. Harley Shaikin, here it is. The argument that we've heard for several decades now is American labor needs to migrate up the skills ladder, let these lower skill, lower education level jobs go to other countries and work in a higher tier of technology, a higher tier of the economy. Is that proving to be a workable solution?
Not at all. In fact, some of the most highly skilled jobs are as exportable as those at the very lowest end. So we see software in India. We see automobile engine production in Mexico. We see Intel with a new factory in Costa Rica. There's nothing more important for American workers than to see development and jobs in other countries in the world. It's not that these interests are counterposed. It's rather the basis on which this takes place. In a very real way, solidarity for American workers is now a very global phenomena. If workers in Costa Rica do better, then American workers do better, and you see markets grow in both places, and ironically, trade even expand. But the notion that there is some invisible barrier that will keep highly skilled jobs here and will simply lose those at the lowest end doesn't really reflect the reality out there that's out there today globally.
But Harley Shaikin, if we don't let the kind of economic invisible hand decide where jobs end up, then what are we talking about? Some kind of international regime of economic planning? That doesn't sound practical.
Well, we have an international regime of economic planning right now. Let's take the World Trade Organization. It's not an invisible hand. The document that defined the WTO is 22,500 pages long.
Fair enough.
That's a lot of regulation.
Mm-hmm.
But how many pages reflect labor or environment or environmental conditions? Few or none.
Well, there's a perspective on it. Chris is calling from Green Bay, Wisconsin. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Hello there.
Hi.
First time I've ever gotten on the air for anything. I'm in a cell phone, so I'm going to say my piece, and then I'll hang on as long as I can.
Fire away.
The part about patriotism and whether the corporation should have it or not.
Yes, sir.
I think with what's happened with Enron and all recently should point out that the powers that be in corporations don't care a flip about patriotism or anything else. They're out to make money. If they can do it if they're going to get away with going overseas and moving and getting away from taxes and getting out of all that stuff through loopholes that the government gives them, they're going to do it.
Chris, are you a union member, and what do you see in your line of work?
I own a small trucking company. None of us, with very few exceptions in this industry, are unionized. I would like to be. We're getting trashed, to put it mildly. And I've heard some good stuff from your guests today and all, but me or any individual of us little people, what can we start doing now? I mean, all these, for here.
Well, there's the question, and we'll take it straight to Harley Shaikin. And Chris, thank you very much for your call. Harley Shaikin, Chris drives a truck. He wishes he was unionized, but it's not an industry that's much unionized anymore. And he asks, what can he do to push for the improvement of labor conditions in the U.S.?
I would answer that two ways. We've got to go back to basics. On one level, to reflect on the economic success of this country historically, it's had two things associated with it: high productivity and high wages. And the second thing is that unions have been an important component of those high wages. We've lost the checks and balances that are vital to make this economy function. And we pride ourselves justifiably in being a democratic society. You can go out and join a political party, Democrat or Republican or Green or any other one, without the fear of losing your job,
mm-hmm.
Or worse. But you cannot go out and join a union with that same basic democratic right. And until we restore that basic sense of balance in this country, we have a fear factor that works against joining unions, and we have an important imbalance that's important to redress in terms of the checks and balances of a growing economy.
Is either major political party ready to stand up for that right?
At this point, not really. It's the failure to have that right that is really key to understanding a lot of the issues that we're facing. That said, on issues of globalization, there has been some important movement and a real redefinition of the debate to look at labor rights and environmental standards on a global scale. But until we have that basic democratic right in place, that you can join a union with the ease of joining a political party or not join a union with the same ease, until that basic right is in place, then we have a pretty serious problem.
Chris, I don't know if that defines an action plan for you, but I hope it gives some perspective. Dan is on the line. Welcome, Dan. You're on the air.
Hi, Chris.
Hi.
I got two points.
Okay.
One, Chris was saying that, you know, people ought to have the right to and freedom to join a union.
Yes.
That doesn't exist. When a union comes in, my experience has been you're either in the union or you're out of a job. That's it. I've belonged to two unions in my work history of over 40 years. Neither one of the unions has done anything for the rank and file. The union stewards, the union leadership, the upper management, they get the raises, they get all of the money. The guy down the bottom of the ladder gets nothing.
So you didn't see the big bennies?
There is no bennies in a union. Unions are a dinosaur. They were good around the late 1800s, the early 1900s. They're obsolete now. And the second point I'd like to make is...
Dan, hold the second point. I want to put that one first to Harley Shaken. Harley Shaken, respond to Dan's critique.
Well, there are unions that are not been affected. There are bad unions. But I don't think that's the rule. I think that's the exception. We have to, again, look back. Pensions. Do we like those? Well, those came from strikes and from real union activity. Paid health care on the job for those workers who enjoy it. Same thing. Political pressures that resulted in the Fair Labor Practices Act that gave us overtime and the minimum wage. Those all result from the history of unionization in this country. But rather than this being a historical subject, we really have to look towards the future, particularly at this moment, in an era of corporate scandals and the Enrons of this world. If we didn't have a labor movement, we'd genuinely have to invent it right now. Some institution that speaks for ordinary people, some institution that puts on the agenda the concerns of working families.
Dan, give me your second point and make it fast. We're running out of time.
Second point is that in the United States, we don't make money out of manufacturing things. It's a historical cycle. When I went to management school 30 years ago, they were talking about all of the heavy industry, the automobile, the textile, the shoemaking, everything moving offshore because the climate was better. They could get the same degree of quality out of the workers. They didn't have to put up with all the political nonsense and the taxes, and they didn't have to worry about unions either.
Dan, we got it. Our clock is running down. Thanks for your call. Harley Shaken, can we have manufacturing back in this country and have it with union jobs at good wages? Or is that, as Dan suggests, a matter of history?
Manufacturing is a smaller part of the economy, but more vital than ever because of all the linkages between manufacturing and the service sector. But beyond that, these issues are as important, if not more important, in the high-tech areas of the economy, in the service sector, on university campuses, throughout the economy. How do ordinary people benefit from economic change and benefit from the globalization of the economy? Unless we answer those questions, then it isn't just a question of manufacturing. It's the basic rights that people have in the workplace and ultimately a healthy economy.
Harley Shaken, we're going to have to come back and talk about this again, but it's been great having you. Thanks so much for being on tonight.
Thank you.
Harley Shaken is director of Berkeley's Center for Latin American Studies and author of The New International Division of Labor and Its Impact on Unions. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're